Well, thanks for coming along. Those of you who are looking at me rather than Philip will have seen me give a sort of involuntary snort when he talked about expertise, because I'm just a humble engineer and not a scientist. And it's 11 years since I last taught engineering. So let's see how we get along this evening. I have decided I would pitch this for mid-teens, and I hope that it interests everybody who's here. Now, let's begin with a walk. I want to take you for a moment to Cambridge. So you see it in the map behind me. Zoom in on the west side of the city, and then zoom in again on the Cavendish Laboratory. And at the risk of doing something terrible with the projector, I'll try this. So I studied in the Whittle Laboratory, which is up about here, mechanical engineering, and here's the Cavendish Laboratory. So it was just down the road, 5 minutes. Look at the front door of the Cavendish Laboratory, and this is what you see, and you're saying, what am I looking at? Well, you're looking at the text which is carved over the front door. Great are the works of the Lord, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. Psalm 111, verse 2. And it's Miles Coverdale's translation. So why is it there? Well, it's there at the suggestion of a PhD student called Andrew Briggs, who in 1973, just as the laboratory was opening up, suggested that the text should be put over the front door. And it was taken by his supervisor, Professor Brian Pippard, who was the 7th Cavendish Professor of Physics. He put it as a proposal to the policy committee of the Department of Physics. He was confident that it would be vetoed. To his great surprise, it wasn't. They agreed. So why? Why on earth is a text from the Bible put over the front door to one of the premier physics laboratories in the world? And the answer is that this text, only in Latin, was originally carved over the oak doors into the original Cavendish Laboratory in the centre of Cambridge. And almost certainly it was put there at the behest of the first Cavendish professor, James Clerk Maxwell. Now, Maxwell was an evangelical Christian, a Scot, a Presbyterian. And Maxwell was convinced that it's the Bible that provides the justification for physics. Now, Maxwell is no lightweight. Maxwell is regarded as the third most important physicist of all time. And Albert Einstein said that he didn't stand on the shoulders of Isaac Newton. He stood on the shoulders of Maxwell. So Maxwell is a true heavyweight. And Maxwell said, great are the works of the Lord, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. In Maxwell's effects after his death, this was found. He had written, Almighty God, who hast created man in thine own image, and made him a living soul that he might seek after thee, and have dominion over thy creatures, teach us to study the works of thy hands, that we may subdue the earth to our use, and strengthen the reason for thy service. I will stop there, not read the whole thing. Now, clearly there's a strong allusion here to Genesis chapter 1. And especially verses 26 to 28, where God speaks about creating mankind in his image and giving mankind dominion over all that God had made, so that through the exercise of our God-given powers, which includes our rational faculty, we might exploit and harness the world that God has set us within, so that we may enjoy life better and know God better. That was the perspective of the third most influential physicist of all time. And yet we live in an age in which it's assumed by Christians, as well as by non-Christians, that the answer to the question, what has the Bible got to do with science, is nothing, nothing at all. That science is an essentially naturalist, materialist pursuit. That the Bible is at best irrelevant, but at worst it actually gets in the way of fruitful scientific pursuits. And of course the bête noire of this is the creationists. And the world in which we live assumes that Maxwell's views are just private religious sentiment with no actual positive bearing on his scientific work. So he's compartmentalized his life, is the way we would view it now. His religion's here, nice and neat, in his own bedroom when he goes home to pray, and his work in the laboratory is over here, and never the two shall meet. So what I want this evening is to show you that this is actually historically wrong, and that people who reject the Bible's worldview certainly can go about their scientific work. Of course they can. And they can be very successful and fruitful in their work. But the foundations for what they do, the foundations of modern science, have been provided by the worldview of the Bible. So to try and do this, I want to try and answer three questions. First of all, what is science and how is it done? And then, what is the Bible and how is it read? And finally, who is Yahweh and why is he different? So, what is science and how is it done? Just a bit of light relief. I love Calvin and Hobbes. So Calvin says to his friend Susie, or is it his enemy Susie? Curiosity is the essence of the scientific mind. For example, you know how milk comes out of your nose if you laugh while drinking? Yep. Well, I'm going to see what happens when I inhale milk into my nose and laugh. I'm guessing it will shoot out of my ears. Don't you want to see? And she goes off, idiocy is the essence of the male mind. Okay, light relief. But there's three things here. There's an hypothesis. There is an experiment. And then there is an observation, and there's going to be another observation from the experiment. Experiment, observation, hypothesis. Let's ignore that. Because that's how science is done. And I know that this is a gross oversimplification. I'm not that stupid. But these are the three basic parts of the scientific method. And it's a circle. We can start wherever we want, but we'll start here with an hypothesis. I'm going to say, this is how the world works, isn't it? Well, let's perform an experiment. We're going to design an experiment that will test the hypothesis. Out of the experiment will come results, and we're going to sit and scratch our heads while we try to interpret those results. And hopefully, out of the results, we'll have something which will confirm the hypothesis or refute the hypothesis or enable us to refine the hypothesis. That's how science works. truly speaking. And it's a bit like threading beads together. The beads are the facts. They are, I don't like to call them brute facts, but the facts don't necessarily speak for themselves. Each one has a sound, if you like, but they don't form sentences. Your job as a sadist is to thread the facts together so that they begin to make sense. They begin to make sentences. So you thread them together, you provide an interpretative theory so that the facts begin to tell a story and make predictions. That's the scientific method, and I expect that all of the children here are using that method in school. But you're doing this within a community. No one does this on their own. So from time to time, you're going to publish the results of your work. You're going to tell the community, this is what I've been doing. This is the idea I had. Here's the way I tested it. These are the results. This is my interpretation of the results. Here are the conclusions. What's going to happen? What has happened to my hypothesis? How it's been rejected or confirmed or refined? And you throw this out to the scientific community and they say, nah, we don't like that. Or they say, yeah, that's really good. Or they say, well, okay, we can see what you're saying. And that helps us to refine our own thinking as well. Okay? You're with me? And then, of course, you're not the only person doing this. There's lots of people in your community doing the same sort of thing. They're all particle physicists, or they're all aeronautical engineers. And you are working in a community, okay? So here's our community of aeronautics. That community itself, of course, is part of something larger. The whole enterprise of the scientific community in the world. And it's not just aeronautics. There's all these other scientific fields as well. And sometimes they even interact with one another. And they all share a basic set of commitments. Three basic commitments, without which none of this would work. The first basic commitment is the idea that there is an objective reality. There's the external world. And the external world is not the figment of my imagination. And it's not the figment of your imagination, and it's not the figment of some sort of Gaia imagination. It's real and it's objective. Secondly, there's a commitment to the idea of the operation of natural law. There's a commitment to the idea of cause and effect, and that this is uniform and that it's dependable, and that things work today the way they worked yesterday and will work tomorrow. And that they will work in New Zealand the same way as they work in Northern Ireland. And in fact, they work the same way throughout the expanse of the universe. Natural laws operate and they are uniform and dependable. And then thirdly, there is a commitment to the openness of all of this to human words between inside our grid and what in the world runs between the way we natural law. Three basic shared by all of these communities. And because I'm in three O's, objective relation of natural law, human one better than that, I'm afraid. I apologize. Occupational hazard. It's real. It's ruled, and one better, it's rewarding. And the rewarding bit's important, and we'll back to that later on. It is ticks for doing this. We get ticks ourselves, and we get ticks for the group, and it feels good. And there's a reason for it to feel good. It's part of the scientific process. Now, this has been wonderfully successful. Look, we have a data projector, and we have one of these. Point at the data projector and button something on, and then I'll have to do this again. One sitting around here somewhere. It was wonderfully successful. Blindingly obvious, isn't it? The scientific method. Well, actually, it's only blindingly obvious because we've lived with it all our lives, and it's been around for 400 years. But go somewhere else and ask other people, how do you join the beads together? What sort of threads do you use? Ask a Buddhist. Now, I'm not going to make fun of Buddhists. There are plenty of very, very intelligent Buddhists in the world. Men far more intelligent than I am, and men who've done good work. Okay, so I'm not making fun of anybody. But Buddhism says that the external world is just an illusion, that mind is ultimate, and that everything is one. In other words, there's only one bead, and there's no way you can thread it together. So Buddhism, despite the fact that there are many very intelligent Buddhists, did not give us the modern scientific method. Go down the road and you'll find that neither did Hinduism. Again, this is not to impugn the intelligence of any Hindus, but Hindus emphasize diversity. Hinduism is an exceptionally polytheistic and polyvalent religion. Hinduism loves to conceptualize mind-bogglingly large numbers. And just to throw it out there, do you know what the largest number is? The largest number that has a name attached to it is called Googleplex. So Google, not spelled the same way as a search engine, but Google is 10 to the power of 100. And when we were at school, we loved to put in 69 factorial, because that was as large as our calculators could go to. Put in 70 factorial, you get an error sign. So 10 to the power of 100, that's one with 100 zeros after it, is Google. Then Googleplex is 10 to the power of Google. So it's one with Googleplex zeros after it. Sorry, Google zeros after it, which is more than the number of particles in the universe. So you can't write Googleplex down. But the point is that Hindus just love these mind-bogglingly large numbers. And they glory in the idea of infinity. The result of that in Hinduism is that Hinduism is every man for himself, because there is simply an infinite number of stories you can tell by stringing together the facts in an infinite number of ways. So make up your own story. Polyvalency, many values, no stability, no single scientific story, no scientific method came out of Hinduism. Now, Islam is different from Hinduism in that Islam is monotheistic. So it's got something going for it when it comes to science. And Islam preserved a whole lot of Greek learning. The Islamic scholars preserved Greek texts, which they got when they moved into the eastern part of the Roman Empire. And they preserved all these Greek texts and the Greek learning. And yet, science didn't flourish in the Islamic world. And the reason for that is that in Islam, Allah is absolutely sovereign, in a way which is quite different from the triune God being sovereign. He is sovereign in a way that makes everything deterministic. And if everything is deterministic, then all we have to do is submit to the will of Allah, and there is no benefit to be found in trying to understand how he operates, how his creation operates. So again, not to say that Muslims aren't very intelligent people, but the fact is that the modern scientific method did not come out of Islam. It's not obvious. It seems obvious to us, but it's not obvious. One last one. Well, not quite one last one. There's one after this. What about atheism? Many, probably the majority of modern successful scientists are atheists. Wasn't like that in the past, but it's that way now. And they make big claims for their worldview. And yet, the fact is that atheism is unable to give an account for the inductive method used by science. Bertrand Russell, one of the great thinkers of the 20th century and an atheist, said that without induction, there is no difference between sanity and insanity. And yet Bertrand Russell couldn't give an account for the basis of the inductive method. In other words, the atheistic scientists have to stand on theistic foundations in order to do their work. It's not obvious, after all. And in fairness, it wasn't obvious in the medieval world either. Medieval Christianity was not a breeding ground for the modern scientific method. And in part, this was because of the medieval hermeneutic, the way they interpreted the Bible. So there were four levels of biblical interpretation, the literal being the least important, and then the allegorical, the moral, and the eschatological being very much more important than the literal meaning of the text. What, this is history, really? Nah, let's find something more interesting than that. Let's find a spiritual meaning. That was the emphasis in the medieval world. So for them, natural history was significant only insofar as it provided a set of symbols which aided the interpretation, the spiritual interpretation of the Bible. And much more important than study of the natural world were the sacraments. There were actions to be performed, but those actions weren't on the natural world to understand it. The actions that had to be performed were inside the church, the sacramental actions that kept the church going. So it wasn't obvious in the medieval world either. And then something changed in the 16th century. The Renaissance movement kicks off, well, earlier than the 16th century. But the Renaissance movement kicks off and it has an interest in texts and how to read texts. And they developed the historical grammatical method for reading texts. This is a method for reading the text that you all use and your minister uses as he prepares to preach. But it's not just the minister reading the Bible. We all use this method when we read all different types of literature. This was the Renaissance method, it was the humanist method, and most of the reformers were raised, educated within this humanist mindset, and they then brought it to the way that they read the biblical text. And in this reading, authorial intention becomes primary. The literal meaning, which the medieval church said was the least important, becomes the most important. So this is deliberately made to look like the scientific method that we looked at a few moments ago. We observe the text, so we look at things like the words, the grammar, the syntax, the phrases, paragraphs, the structure of the text, and we try to interpret it. We try to understand what is the author saying to me. And he'll be talking to me probably, if I'm reading a book about history, he'll be talking to me about history, real people, real events. And out of that will come perhaps some application, some way in which I should change my thinking or my behaving. And that change in me, I'll take back to the way that I read the text. That's how the humanists and therefore the reformers began to approach the Bible. And then they said, hang on a moment. Isn't the external world a book as well? Aren't there facts there that we want to put together and read a story out of? And if it's an external, if it's a book as well, then perhaps we can read this book using the historical, grammatical method to discover the author's intention. And so we have our ideas about what the text might be saying, which we test by reading the text or the world, and we reflect on what we've read to see how we should change the way we use the world, and so the system goes round. The way they read the biblical text was ported over to the way they began to read the natural text. So Peter Harrison, in a book called The Bible, Protestantism and the Rise of Natural Sciences, published by Cambridge University Press, so it's not IVP, it's not Crossway, it's a serious publishing house, he has written, "A change took place in the 16th century which challenged the assumption that the purpose of the material world lay in its referential or symbolic functions." In other words, it's just a set of symbols to help us understand the spiritual meaning of the Bible. "Henceforth, the quest for the divinely instituted purpose of nature is diverted solely into the search for its practical utilities." And he goes on, "The modern approach to texts, driven by the agenda of the reformers and disseminated through Protestant religious practices, created the conditions which made possible the emergence of modern science." And another author, Professor Stephen Snobelan, who's an assistant professor of the history of science and technology at King's College University in Canada, he's written, "Recent work on early modern science has demonstrated a direct relationship between the resurgence of the Hebraic literal exegesis of the Bible and the rise of the empirical method in modern science. I'm not referring to wooden literalism, but the sophisticated literal historical or historical grammatical hermeneutics that Martin Luther and others championed. It was in part when this method was transferred to science, when students of nature moved on from studying nature as symbols, allegories, and metaphors to observing nature directly in an inductive and empirical way that modern science was born." What's the Bible got to do with science? Well, we read the Bible and then we learn how we read the book of nature. John Hedley Brooke, in Science and Religion, Some Historical Perspectives, also published by Cambridge University Press, he writes, "The argument is not that Protestant religion constituted a primary, independent variable on which science depended, but that through reciprocal interaction, a higher value was gradually placed on the practical sciences. Put another way, Puritan values helped to create an audience receptive to programs for the improvement of man's estate." So the Puritans, English reformers, they have this perspective on the Bible, and they are changing the way that people think by informing them of a new way to read the Bible, and this makes their audiences the general population receptive to programs for the improvements of man's state. In other words, programs for using the natural world in rational ways that will actually help us live better. He goes on to say that religious belief could function as a presupposition of science need not entail the strong claim that without a prior theology, science would never have taken off. But it does mean that the particular conceptions of science held by its pioneers were often informed by theological and metaphysical beliefs. In other words, this is a modest claim he's making, but it's an important claim nonetheless, that the Bible really was there in the foundation of the modern scientific method. Now, it is a modest claim, so I want to suggest an analogy. Bach was a committed Lutheran. Now, nobody in their right mind would claim that an atheist cannot play Bach, and can't play Bach with great skill, and can't play Bach in a way that gives great enjoyment. Nor would anyone claim that an atheist cannot be creative, musically creative. But the fact is that Bach's music does reflect his Lutheran faith. So we have this modest claim that we are able to affirm the historical fact that the foundations of the scientific method were laid by people who were committed to the biblical worldview, while we also affirm the scientific abilities and the success of people who are committed to a materialist worldview. Okay, so I don't want you to go away thinking that I put down Buddhists or Hindus or Muslims or atheists. Not at all. Because, of course, the biblical worldview tells me they're all created in the image of God. They're all capable of examining God's world. Only they have to use the right foundations, the right perspective, and that is provided by the Bible and what the Bible tells us about God. So one last long quote and then we're almost done. Lauren Isley, who isn't a Christian, or he's dead now, he wasn't a Christian, he wrote a book called Darwin's Century, Evolution and the Men Who Discovered It, published by Doubleday. And he writes, "The philosophy of experimental science began its discoveries and made use of its method in the faith that it was dealing with a rational universe controlled by a creator who did not act upon whim or interfere with the forces he set in operation. The experimental method succeeded beyond men's wildest dreams, but the faith that brought it into being owes something to the Christian conception of God." Wildly successful. But let's not forget that the worldview that brought it into being owes something to the Christian or the biblical conception of God. So who is Yahweh and why is he different? This isn't Yahweh. It's Baal. It's Marduk, Amun-Re, Ishtar, four representatives of the many gods of the pagan world. No image of Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, God of the Bible, because he is distinctively different. He has no image. Let's think about these gods for a moment. This will look really arcane. This will look a bit weird. It'll sound a bit weird. And you'll wonder, what's stuff from 3,500 years, 4,000 years ago got to do with the Bible and science? Well, I hope you see that the worldview of the pagans is quite like the worldview of the atheists. Let's think about a thing called the Emunah Elish. The Emunah Elish is Babylonian cosmogony. So it's kind of about where's the world come from, but more important than that is where do the gods come from? Where are the gods from? And in the Emunah Elish, there are two, if you like, primal gods, primeval gods. There's the saltwater god, the goddess, Tiamat. And there's the freshwater god, Apsu. And somehow their waters merge, mingle together. And out of the merging of their waters, the second tier gods are engendered. Now these new gods, they are upstart gods. They're noisy gods. They're active. They upset Apsu. And he gets a bit annoyed by them. And he says, I am going to destroy these gods. But the gods get wind of that. And Apsu is killed by Ea, who's the father of Marduk. All sort of chaos breaks out. Tiamat's furious, and she makes war with the gods. But in the war, Marduk takes the lead, and Marduk crushes Tiamat with his mace. He splashes her head open, then he takes his knife, and he slits her down the middle and pulls her apart, and half of her ribs he makes into the vault of heaven, and the other half he makes into the earth. This doesn't go down well with the son of Tiamat and Apsu, a guy, a god called Kingu, not Pingu, but Kingu. And Kingu makes war with the other gods, but he's caught and he's punished, and Marduk is given the privilege of slaying him. So he slays Kingu and he takes his blood and he mixes it with clay, and out of the clay he makes mankind. And that's typical of the worldview of the ancient pagans. And there are some features of it that we need to think about. Primeval chaos. Chaos is ultimate. Ultimate reality is impersonal and irrational. There's nothing in these stories that suggests that the creation of the world is something deliberate. Rather, creation happens almost by accident, without either purpose or will on the part of Tiamat or Apsu, which is why later on they can want the whole thing to be undone. And of course, at this point, we're just talking about the creation of the other gods, not even talking about the creation of the world we live in. So we've got chaos as primeval, and ultimate reality is impersonal and irrational. And then these pagan views of reality are all polytheistic, because two primal gods beget in some fashion a pantheon of second division gods. And then these second division gods make war upon the primal gods, indicating that nature is basically unstable. Nature is always just teetering on the edge of falling into chaos, being back into non-being. And the gods are working all the time to try and maintain equilibrium. And it's hard work, which is why they create mankind. So there's continuity of being. The gods, second tier gods, they make mankind out of god stuff. Kingu gets killed. His blood and earth is used to make man. We are made from god stuff. In other words, nature is sacralized. And the relationship, sort of the I-thou relationship between me as the observer and the external world as the observed, that relationship is interfered with. It's not absolute. There's no subject-object distinction. And as a result of that lack of subject-object distinction, people can be exploited. And the gods did this very deliberately. It was hard work looking after this unstable creation, and so they made man to take up the slack. There's another creation myth called the Atrahasis, and in the Atrahasis it says, when the gods, instead of man, did the work, bore the loads, the gods' loads was too great, the work too hard, the trouble too much. So they make man to do the work for them. And that's why, in the pagan world, the king will exploit those people underneath him. Exploitation of human beings is what happens when you have a pagan worldview. Yahweh is different. Yahweh is different, not because the Hebrew people got there by small evolutionary steps. Yahweh is radically different. The Bible reveals an absolute monotheism. You know that there are only three monotheistic religions in the world: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And they all look back to the same basic revelation. Where did that come from? Didn't come by evolutionary steps out of paganism. Anyway, absolute monotheism means that ultimate reality is personal and rational. And even in Judaism and in Christianity, but not in Islam, relational. So ultimate reality is personal, rational, and relational. Then the God who reveals himself in the Bible is one who creates ex nihilo, out of nothing, not out of other God's stuff, and not by accident. So nature bears God's hallmark. Psalm 33 says, he loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth all their host. It comes forth by command, and so it bears the hallmark of his character. He is rational, therefore so is his creation. But at the same time, creation is not sacralized because it's not made out of God's stuff. And this means then that the subject-object distinction is maintained. And nature is stable. And nature is studyable. So the great are the works of the Lord, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. Psalm 111. And then thirdly, in the biblical revelation, we're told that Yahweh makes man in his image. And this puts man into a unique position, described in Psalm 8. In Psalm 8, if you look at it carefully, you'll find that right in the middle of Psalm 8, we have man visited by God, made a little lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor, and everything put under his feet. And as you stand in the middle of the psalm and you look up through it, you see God's work in the skies and you worship Yahweh, the Creator. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And then in the middle of the psalm, you look downwards through the psalm and you see the lower creation, all the fish and the birds and the beasts and so on under your feet, which you've been given rule over to examine, to investigate. And looking through that, again you see the Creator. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. The psalm says that Yahweh has put man in this unique position as his image bearer. And as he studies God's work, he receives God's approval. In Genesis 1, God says, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven and over everything that creeps or moves on the earth." So God gives a warrant for scientific investigation, and he approves of it. And as man studies nature, he does so not only with God's approval, but also with God's presence. In Genesis chapter 2, God brings to the man all the creatures that he had formed to see what the man would call them. And whatever the man called every creature, every living creature, that was its name. God is there, standing beside the man, while the man performs his first scientific investigation. So Peter Harrison says about this, the literal reading of Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, so the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to keep it and to work it. He says, this meshed neatly with the Reformers' doctrine of the priesthood of all believers, according to which all human vocations were equally sacred. All human vocations equally sacred. You can go about your work. Go about it and enjoy it. Do it well and regard that as being worship. So, to sum up, what has the Bible to do with science? Well, the Bible provides the justification for science. We've just seen that the Bible tells us that we were made in the image of God. It tells us about creation out of nothing. It tells us about absolute monotheism. None of it comes from pagan religion. None of this comes from the secular worldview. But out of that, we get science as the study of something which is real, something which is ruled by natural law, something which is rational and which our thinking processes correspond to, and a cultural activity which is rewarding. Those ticks that we feel when we do it well, they're genuine, they're real. So what's the Bible got to do with science? It's the justification for science. I think also we can say that the Bible provides us with what I've called hints for science. The Bible is able to suggest that some lines of inquiry will lead to dead ends. Why would you want to waste your life studying them? While other lines of inquiry will be fruitful. So, in cosmology, do you really want to study cold, dark matter and cold, dark energy when the Bible would suggest that these are just fudge factors put in an effort to shore up the Big Bang theory? Likewise, the Bible gives a worldview which informs geology, and there are features in the geomorphology of the earth which creationists are able to explain out of their understanding of the flood, but which aren't really explicable using the long ages proposed by secular scientists. And what about climatology? I'm not going to say anything controversial, but there are climate models suggested by the Bible, or at least there are hints, let's say, in the Bible about how climatology might be pursued. So what's the Bible got to do with science? I think it provides us with hints, both that this will be a dead end and that that will be a fruitful way to follow your science. And then finally, the Bible provides science with ethics. It says to scientists, you've got to tell the truth when you're reporting the results of your investigations. And from time to time, you will hear about scientists who get caught out because they haven't told the truth. But then as well as that, and perhaps, well, just as important as that, the Bible puts limits on what should be done and what should not be done. Because the Bible reveals that people are precious. People are not to be exploited in the quest for knowledge and the power that knowledge gives. So what has the Bible got to do with science? It provides science with foundations, provides science with hints, and provides science with ethics. None of this comes from outside the Bible. Let James Clerk Maxwell have the last word. He said, and remember, he is the third most important scientist to have lived ever. He said, "I've looked into most philosophical systems, and I've seen that none will work without God." Well, thank you very much for your attention.